Charlie ended the call, then grabbed a handful of Ellery's t-shirt and yanked. Ellery stumbled into the diner, but it did not deter them and Charlie as they jostled against each other for space to peek through the small circular window into the diner seating area. Sure enough, the hot weird guy stood at the counter, long pale fingers drumming on the linoleum countertop as he talked to Marisol, one of the other waitresses, to pick up his order. His black hair was cut close at the sides and long on top, brushed forward with what Charlie had dubbed emo bangs. He wore large sunglasses that he didn't take off despite being indoors, and when he smiled, it was wide and cheerful and showed off perfect straight teeth that would have made an orthodontist weep. Ellery looked, definitely appreciating his sharp jawline, smooth skin, and pink bow mouth. And while Ellery could also appreciate the visage, they weren't one to say it out loud or do anything about it. Admiring from afar was good enough for them, thank you, because anything else would require social interaction, of which Ellery was not usually a fan. And well, Hot Weird Guy was 1000% out of Ellery's league in every reality. They couldn't deny that the hot part of the nickname was apt. That's a quote from Otherworldly by F.T. Lukens. This is YA Book Chat, and I'm your host, Leah Stuhler. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of YA Book Chat. Thank you so much for being here and for continuing to listen. I appreciate your support. Today, I will be chatting with F.T. Lukens, who is the author of In Deeper Waters, So This Is Ever After, which was number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list, Spellbound, which was also on the New York Times bestseller list. And today we are talking about their brand new fantasy, Otherworldly, which just published on April 2nd. Well, thank you so much for being here today, FT. It is so great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about the book.
Me too. I absolutely adored this book. And this was my first venture into a like cozy fantasy. So it was very fun. And I cannot wait to talk about this. Before we get started chatting about the book, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
I am F.T. Lukens. I am an author of YA queer speculative fiction, mainly in the fantasy space. And Otherworldly is my, can't believe it, but it's my 9th book out. And I live in the mountains of North Carolina.
I am actually in South Carolina, so not too far from you.
Oh yeah, not far at all.
And I love it down here. I grew up in Western New York and then lived in Chicago for 11 years. And then when my husband was looking for a new job and decided to look out of state, I said, can we just go somewhere warm now? Because I'm done with the cold. So here we are. But I enjoy North Carolina as well. Also, we've been there multiple times because it's so close. It's really nice.
It is super close. I'm lucky to live in a spot where I'm an hour from Tennessee, an hour from South Carolina, and then about an hour and a half from Georgia.
Nice. That's kind of how we are too, because we're in the right in the smack dab in the middle of the state. So we're very close to North Carolina and Georgia and Tennessee, and even going to Florida is not that far. So it's nice. Well, let's chat about your books and your writing. So, okay, you've got these fantastic fantasy, speculative queer books that you are writing with romance in them. What drew you to writing these types of stories?
Well, I have always loved fantasy. Fantasy is fantasy and sci-fi is pretty much my wheelhouse, and it's you know the things I loved reading and watching growing up, and I was really quickly immersed into like geek culture and nerd culture when I was very small because I have an older brother who is 13 years older than I am, and that's what he was into. So when I was little, you know, we would watch movies together that were like Star Wars, and he did Dungeons and Dragons, and I found his, you know, monster guides under his bed and read those. And he would send me books when he moved away. So I've always really just enjoyed that kind of media, the fantasy and sci-fi media. But as for romance, I don't know. I'm just kind of a sucker for a meet cute or a meet disaster. Yes.
Yes.
I love when characters find their happy ever after. Even if it's, a hard won happy ever after, or even like a cozy happy ever after, or but I like writing that, and I like writing it in a fantasy space.
I love a real good meet cute. It's just so fun. Like, I'm always of when I'm reading something, whether it's a fantasy or contemporary or whatever it is, and as soon as the two main characters meet, who I know are going to have a romance, I'm always like, that was okay, or that was like the best meet cute ever. So cute. So I'm always like a sucker for those type of things too.
I love them, like you said, a really good meet cute. But I like weird ones too. Like, and that's why I love writing romance in a fantasy setting, because you can do so much with it. And you can have the meet cute in Spellbound, there was a cursed doll involved. The meet cute in Otherworldly, is when one of them, it's more of a meet disaster, is one of them is running away from like supernatural creatures, and they barrel into each other in a dark alley. So it's always fun being able to come up with like these, fun things and apply romance tropes to fantasy settings and stories.
Yes, absolutely. So I want to ask you, because you just said, you grew up in like this nerd culture with your brother. I'm curious now, what are some things that you are like a nerd about? Because I know for me, like you mentioned Star Wars, that is definitely one of mine. And I'm also a Trekkie. I love Star Trek. The Princess Bride is probably the thing I am the most nerdiest about ever in the entire world. Lots of things. So what are you a nerd about?
So Star Wars, definitely the whole Star Wars universe, the expanded universe before it was no longer canon. I had read all those books, and I, had watched all the movies, even the Ewok movie, even
Yes.
the even the much maligned holiday special. So I was really into that. But like, when I was in college, I was part of the sci-fi and fantasy club, which we called SCIFFY.
Oh, fun.
And my like real knowledgeable geek out, section of nerd culture or geek culture was like 80s and 90s fantasy and sci-fi TV shows. Like, I know them all.
I just read Pieces of a Girl by Stephanie Kuhnert, which is her memoir. And at the beginning, and I realized from reading it, she's only like a year older than I am. So we're in the same space. So at the beginning of it, she talks about how she grew up like going over to her best friend's house and they would just have like Star Trek marathons. And I was like, yes, totally what my best friend and I did too, because I love sci-fi and Star Trek and Star Wars are just right there.
My friend and I, in high school, my best friend and I, we loved Highlander, the series. And that was our one that we would get together and watch and binge watch and go over to each other's houses. And I'm dating myself, but this is long before the age of streaming. So like we would, you had to record TV shows onto a VHS.
Yes, same. Oh my goodness,
So we would do
delightful.
that, and then we would watch what we recorded. Yeah, that's what it was. Highlander, the series, was like the big one for me in high school, as well as like a couple other things like Star Trek, of course, The Next Generation, which is, I say it's why I almost failed AP calculus, because it was on at midnight and 1 a.m. for me. So I stayed up and watched it.
I mean, you have to. Where I am, one of the stations has Star Trek like every weeknight, Monday through Friday, but they do like all of them. So they have, it'll be like, the original Star Trek will be on, and then right after it is Next Generation, and then right after that is Deep Space Nine, and then right after that is Voyager. I have definitely stayed up late way too many nights, like just binging all watching all of them because I can, because it's Star Trek.
I mean, like I totally get it. So I will say that for Star Trek, for me, it's next gen. And I like the original series. I do like Deep Space Nine. But I haven't like seen all of Voyager, and I haven't seen all of Enterprise, and I haven't caught up with Discovery or Picard, which I know I'm a bad person. I haven't
No,
caught
no,
up.
no.
I'm a
It's
bad geek.
fine.
But I know what you mean, because I could sit there and do that with, like, anything that would come on the sci-fi channel, and I would sit and just watch the sci-fi channel from before it became sci-fi. The old sci-fi channel, when they would do like Xena and Jack of all trades, and then Briscoe County Jr. and just sit there and watch.
Same. Oh my goodness. I love it. Well, we definitely have that connection there because I am the same. Oh.
Exactly.
Well, based on like, what I've read, what I've seen online, I feel like your books have really been like steadily gaining more popularity. And actually, the reason that I picked up the arc of this, like when Alex emailed me and was like, "Hey, are you interested in this?" I was like, "Oh yeah, but I actually already have an arc. You don't even have to send me one." I picked it up at Y'all Fest in Charleston this past November because as I was walking around at Y'all Fest, I heard multiple people being like, "Oh, I'm super excited about that new F.T. Lukens book. I can't wait to read it. I can't wait to read it." And I was like, "All right, maybe this is something I got to check out." So, and then the publisher emailed me and I was like, "Well, this is perfect." So, what is that like as a writer to kind of like, you start with your first one and then you get these bestsellers on the New York Times bestselling list and then you have, this kind of thing where it's just the popularity just grows. Does that ever get old or is it just like always this really cool thing?
It's just unreal. It really is. It feels, a dream come true. It's something I've been working towards for a long time, even though I never really thought I could be a published author until I was older. But it's something that I can't wrap my mind around it sometimes. And then I'll like get messages from folks or emails, or people will tag me in things on social media, and it's like, okay, there are people out there reading these things and reading my books and enjoying my stories. And I'm gonna tell you an embarrassing story. I go to Dragon Con in Atlanta every year, and I've been going since 2016. I missed COVID year, and I missed 1 year because I had COVID. But I've been going, pretty regularly. And there was one time I was there, and it was very early on in my career, and it was one of my independent press published books. And someone came up to me and they went, "Excuse me, are you F.T. Lukens?" And I went, "Why?" And they were like, "Can you sign this?" And I was like,
Whoops. Oh, I
"Oh,
love
yeah."
that.
But so it's still very, like, it's still when people ask me to sign something, or send me these messages and that kind of stuff, it's still very, like, it never gets old. And it's still very just it still feels very new.
I love that. I love hearing that. That's so fun because you can tell too then that with that feeling still there, that it's something that's still so exciting and that writing is something that you still really love to do. And I love that. Why don't you tell everyone what Otherworldly is about?
So, Otherworldly, I have been saying it's my weird paranormal romance book. It is about the main character, Ellery, who is a teen whose family has been stuck in a 5-year winter, the region they live in. And they are a skeptic of all things supernatural because they don't believe in the gods and goddesses that their peers and their family believe in. And they are dead set that there is a scientific explanation for this winter. And they suddenly meet Knox, who is the other main character, in a darkened alley by accident. And Knox just happens to be a supernatural being.
Oh,
So it's really them teaming up and making a crossroads bargain to help figure out the unending winter for Ellery, but also help Knox experience some humanity.
Let me tell you what, if I was stuck in perpetual winter for 5 years, I would probably be right there with Ellery on the side of these gods aren't real because why would they do this to me? Be stuck in winter forever.
So Ellery was a really difficult balance to strike because Ellery is a little abrupt and a little brusque and is just kind of a jerk in the beginning. And it really is because they are disillusioned. They've had to grow up quickly. Their family has, hurt them in a couple of different ways, and they're just kind of wrapped up in that and can't see beyond it. And then they go, they meet Knox and they have their cousin and their cousin's girlfriend, along for the ride too, and gods and goddesses. And they really blossom throughout the book. But I didn't want to make them, I was a little worried that readers would find them too of a jerk, too much of a jerk. But I swear, they get better.
I agree. They do get better. Like, if it's any consolation, I don't feel like they were too much of a jerk at all. I thought they were great.
Well, that's
And
good.
I mean, frankly, Ellery kind of has a little bit of a reason to be a jerk. Like, I mean, there are some tough circumstances there and things that happen. So I was like, well, they kind of deserve to have a little bit of this attitude here. So it was okay, at least for me. Like, I was fine with it.
Well, also, if you think about it, they're 17 when the story starts, and it's always already been 5 years. So the majority of their teen life has been stuck in this winter, and they're a little bitter about it.
Let me tell
And
you,
also, I gave them like the worst job you can have, as a dishwasher.
Yep. I had to do that job myself for a little while when I was in college. Like, when you're a freshman in college at the college I went to and you worked in the kitchen, that was like your job as a freshman. And I hated it. It was really horrible. So I could totally relate to Ellery when they were washing the dishes and not happy about it.
So I gave Ellery a job, that job, because I did that as a teen. I worked at an ice cream stand, and at the end of the day, one of the things we had to do was like wash the dishes and the hot fudge and the caramel and like get it. Oh, it was so gross.
Not fun. So, how did the idea for Otherworldly come about?
Otherworldly started with really, my desire to write the dynamic between a skeptic and a supernatural being. So it really started with the character creation. And all of my books are different because Spellbound started with the actual creation of the magic system. And then I populated that world with the characters. But for Otherworldly, I started with the actual characters because I knew that was the dynamic I wanted to write. And so I created Ellery, I created Knox, and then from there, and I knew a little bit about how the story would go. Like, I wanted them to have that meat disaster that we talked about, and I wanted them to butt heads, but also enter a bargain. So those were all kind of very early ideas. But the world was basically built out from the characters. So I knew Knox was going to be a supernatural being. And so I was like, okay, what kind of being do I want him to be? Who is his goddess going to be? Well, if there's a goddess, there has to be other gods and goddesses. If she's a chthonic goddess because she's ruling the seasons, that's why this 5-year winter, then what's her iconography? What is this world, the realm that she lives in? And so really it just kind of, that's how the world creation and the narrative creation started.
And I love that. I always love talking to authors and finding out like how they build their stories and their worlds because everybody just does things so differently. And so it's great to hear different perspectives and how you kind of started building things. So Otherworldly is set in the fictional city of Solis City, and it has this kind of like contemporary feel to it, but because we do also have the magical element to it, there is this fantastic magic system that you were just talking about. So tell me about how you developed the magic system and kind of how the magic works and changes with the setting.
Yeah, so it takes place in a contemporary setting, but just kind of moved over a bit from our world and into like a fantasy realm. And it's actually kind of what I wanted to build the city itself in that particular setting. The way I did that was I knew I wanted to have, the city, but I also wanted to have this kind of idea of once you left the city and drove for 20 to 30 minutes, that you would start hitting like farmland and a rural kind of area. And that's really true for a lot of cities throughout, our country and everything, because, in Asheville, North Carolina, where I live, you drive outside of it for a little ways and you hit mountains. In the Midwest, you have big cities and you drive outside for a little bit and you hit corn. That setting was a very particular setting because I wanted to have it be relatable to readers. And I've done quite a few podcasts already, and the feedback I've gotten from the other readers were like, "Oh, I thought it was set in the Northwest, in the Pacific Northwest." And someone else was like, "I thought it was set in the South." And I was like, "No, it's, fictional, but it's Ohio." But anyway, so that was a really particular setting, and that came from the help of a friend, D.L. Wainwright, who writes folklore and horror. And I was having a conversation with him about, setting this and making it a contemporary fantasy. And we were talking about like creepy settings to have and where I could put this crossroads. And DL was like, "Well, cornfields are creepy." And I was like, "They are." And so that's where, that kind of that setting came from. But that didn't answer your question about magic systems.
That's
And
okay.
really, the magic system in this book is that I wanted to have a lot of kind of superstition. And that kind of follows that idea of the settings in the book are a lot of the big scenes happen in spaces that would feel creepy to us, liminal spaces, like a darkened alley, an abandoned mall, that kind of thing. And then to have this kind of underlying, eeriness throughout the novel, but also all this superstition built in, like having the horseshoe over the door, the acorn wrapped in wire, the lucky charms that two of the characters carry. And so to have kind of a blending of this kind of horror background, then have like the superstition on top of that, and then add the world building elements of, well, why, who is Nox's queen? And if there, like I said, if there is a goddess, then there has to be a god here and a goddess here. And oh, what if they have children? Okay, that's minor gods. And then, oh, what if they create something? Well, those are the creations, and kind of fleshing it out like that.
Okay, and cornfields, yes, like why? I don't know, but they're super creepy. Although I probably have more of a the probably for me the reason that I am will forever be creeped out about cornfields is thanks to M. Night Shyamalan and his movie Signs. Like I will never go near one again. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I don't need creepy, weird aliens in my cornfield, so that's mine.
You know, I'd forgotten about that movie until you
Oh my
mentioned it.
gosh. That movie freaked me out. He did a really good job with that movie.
There is one jump scare in that movie that really got me. And I was dating somebody, and we were in the theater watching that movie. And I was already kind of tense because it's a creepy movie. And I was leaning up against the person. And when there's a scene where the alien walks across the screen, and it made me jump. And that person also jumped. And so
That
then I like yelped.
really is a jump scare moment. Like it's so fast, but it is just creepy. Oh man. But I loved how you did build in like the creep factor into this too, because the even just like that the opening prologue when Arabelle goes to the crossroads and just picturing the crossroads and the sign that's there and all the little offerings to the gods, and then when those shades appear, I was like, oh, okay. And those things are super creepy. So tell me about the shades and like developing them, because I'm telling you, I got like the biggest creep feel and creep factor from them.
Well, the shades are a mix of, well, first off, there's three shades because the number three pops up in, different mythology and religion all the time. So that's why there's three. And the shades are kind of a combination of the three witches from Macbeth, Nazgul from The Lord of the Rings,
Love that.
and the fates from like Disney's Hercules.
That is an awesome combination. Like, I love that. I can see all of that in them. Okay, so the funny thing is that despite like the creep factor of this that is in this book, it is being called like a cozy fantasy. And because it's, like it has its low trigger plot lines and stakes, it does have this sweet love story. And we've got some like slice of life premises too. And I really enjoyed it because it does really feel very like cozy and warm. It gives you like this warm, snuggly feeling despite the like creep factor stuff, which, in itself, I feel like is a really big accomplishment right there. Being able to make your readers feel this like warm coziness despite the like creepy stuff that's happening. I loved it. I love, I felt really connected to both Ellery and Knox and their story. And I was just curious, like, why you with this book like chose to go kind of like this cozy fantasy route versus something that was maybe like a typical fantasy, which might be like a little bit more intense or have a little bit of a like spicier romance.
You know what? I really don't know. I think that's just the way it worked out because it's being called cozy fantasy because, like you said, it's slice of life, and it's also very personal stakes. And for me, when I'm developing a story, I really lean into characterization and character growth and character journey, and that's the kind of stuff that I like to see. And I like to have those moments where you get to really know the relationships and how the characters interact with each other. And sometimes in faster paced fantasies or, in high stakes fantasies, you lose those small moments that get let you really know, who that character is and why that character is making that decision, or you kind of miss that romance interaction or the familial interaction or like the friend, the best friends and that kind of stuff. So I really like to highlight those moments. And I also think it was, just a function of the plot, since Knox's plot, and his story arc and his character arc is about experiencing what it means to be human, because he's not all the way human. And he has gleaned a lot of his information about the human realm from science fiction and fantasy TV shows, like we talked about earlier. And so he's got this kind of idea of these things that he feels like are, milestones for humans. So, going to a party or going to a sporting event or those kinds of things. And so those are really like low stake kind of scenes. But again, it's all driving towards that character development.
And I really loved seeing this character development. And actually, this book actually has one of my favorite tropes in it, which is found family. Because we've got, Ellery and Knox, and Ellery is living with her their their cousin and her girlfriend. And then Knox ends up kind of like being taken in by Charlie and Zeta as well. And they just kind of create this like wonderful little family unit. And we do get to see this slice of life. We get to see so much of their relationships and how they interact with each other. I love Charlie and Zeta's relationship. They are so fun. I also love how annoyed Ellery gets about it because it's hilarious. But they're just so supportive of each other and they're there for each other. And no matter what happens. So talk to me about developing their relationships and this family dynamic that they have.
Well, I knew that Ellery was going to move away from their home into the city, and I didn't want to put them on their own because that would just add to their angst. So I wanted to make sure that they had a kind of support system in the city that was helping them. And that's where Charlie and then Zeta also came from, was this idea of, not wanting Ellery to be on their own, but also knowing that Ellery's first reaction to Knox and Knox being like, "Yo, I'm familiar," and Ellery's like, "No, you're not." That to be able to, continue them bumping into each other and having to, work around each other kind of thing, is that I needed Knox to be able to become part of that family unit. So I needed characters that were going to help Ellery and Knox both on their character journeys, but also we're going to reach out to Knox and allow him to sleep on the couch and couch surf. But also we're going to be there to help Ellery work through their really complicated feelings about their family and their complicated romantic feelings about Knox. And so that's where Charlie and Zeta came from. And Charlie, even though Charlie is a very warm and very kind cousin, Charlie is a little bizarre. And so having Charlie be that way, I was like, well, I got to balance Charlie out. So where Zeta is more that kind of calm, collected individual, I love Zeta because even though she is like kind of the adult in the room at any given time, Zeta is also the first to be like, you want to go to a party? Let's go to a party.
Oh my goodness. I had so much fun reading about these characters and the four of them together. It was just like, I don't want to say it was like an episode of Friends or something, but it's just like you can just so feel their connectedness together. And it was just, there's so much fun because, like you're saying, they do all have such different personalities. And Ellery is kind of like, y'all are crazy almost. Like sometimes, because Charlie and Zeta do all the things, and Knox is a supernatural being, and then Ellery's just kind of okay and just kind of there in the middle sometimes.
Also, I wanted to make sure that Charlie and Zeta both, even if they aren't of the same beliefs as Ellery's family, they're also very willing to believe. And they are not kind of the hardened skeptic that Ellery is. And they're both very like, oh, Knox is a supernatural being. Sweet. There's no question there. And Charlie is even like, I knew I saw a dryad in the grocery store. Because they're both very willing to accept the things that there's other stuff, beyond their ability to see or hear and touch. And Ellery's just not that person. So having them kind of in that middle space between the extremes of Knox versus Ellery also really helped that relationship between Knox and Ellery grow, because they allowed Ellery to they are allowed They talked to Ellery and kind of brought them more toward the center. And then they were also there to support Knox and kind of be like, this is what humans do. So the other thing about Charlie is this was not intentional until I was like three-fourths of the way through the draft. And then I was like, oh, that's hilarious. And so I kept it going. Was that Charlie calls Zeta a different pet name every time she talks about her. And originally, it was just by accident I had done that. But then when I noticed it, I was like, I'm just gonna keep going. And they get weirder and weirder.
They do, but it is so fun. I noticed that too, and I was like, this is hilarious. Like, I love it. These are just, they're such great characters and they're so fun. I just love reading about each one of them and feeling like I felt like I was part of their little family. Like, I wanted to be part of their family. I was like, can I come move in with you? You know, once the winter is gone, though, of course, once they figure that out. I don't want to live in perpetual winter. There's a reason I live in South Carolina now. I wanted to ask you too a little bit more about your writing process because Otherworldly has a dual POV, which was great. So we get to experience a story from both Knox and Ellery's points of view. So tell me what it's like for you writing a dual POV versus writing just like a single one. Do you have one that you prefer over the other one? Are they both like equally challenging or?
The majority of my books are single POV, and they're either in third person limited or first person. I had written solely in third person limited, single POV, the first six books I wrote, and or six books I published. Let's be real, not everything I wrote got published. So the six books that I published. And then so this is our after I switched and I did first person POV because I really wanted, that's where a lot of the comedic moments come from that book. And then in Spellbound is the first time I did dual POV. And it's kind of because I had labored under this misconception that when you did dual POV, that you had to give an equal amount of voice to each character. And I read a book by Beth Revis, Give the Dark My Love. And I read it and she uses POV so great in that book. It's dual POV, but it's like 75-25. So it's majority of the one character, but then we get snippets of the other character. And I was like, that's really smart. And I was like, I could maybe do a dual POV if I could do that. So I have read books that alternate POV each chapter. I talked to Camilla Cole, who wrote So Let Them Burn, about this because that's how she wrote hers. So Let Them Burn is alternating dual POV. And I told her, I was like, that is just magic. There is no way, because that takes a lot of planning and it takes a lot of structure to be able to do it. And she did it so brilliantly in that book. And I'm jealous of her ability to do that. So yeah, when I was writing Otherworldly, I knew I wanted to have, because both Ellery and Knox go on character journeys. So I wanted to make sure that they were both represented. And so that's why there's the dual POV. However, it's not equal. And it really was, the chapter really was determined by who is the best character to give me this scene to get the most information to the reader, or give the most emotional reaction to the reader, or drive the plot a certain way. So it was really just kind of based on that, of which of these two characters for this particular scene is going to be the better POV to write it from. And it's, I'm not gonna lie, it's challenging.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And like yours has two POVs, right? I've read books that have like four or five, and I'm just like, how do you keep that straight? How do you do that? Like, that's crazy.
Yeah,
So.
I one of my favorite books that does multiple POV very well is The Mermaid, the Witch, and the Sea. And it's by Maggie Takeuta Hall. It is a fantasy kind of piratey novel. And I was so enthralled with it because of the dual POV, but also because like the sea has a P point of view in that book. And it was really interesting when I was reading it. I was like, man, that's awesome. So there's definitely books out there that can do dual POV, multiple POV very well. But I just hadn't really tried it until I read Give the Dark My Love and just saw the way that Beth Revis had done that in her book. And I was like, you know, it really kind of changed my thinking around dual POV.
Yeah. And I will say, like, even though their POVs aren't even, it doesn't feel off. Like, as a reader, I don't even notice. You know what I mean? Like, for me, it's not like, oh, Knox has less chapters than Ellery. There's more in their POV than there are in Knox's. Like, it doesn't feel that way to me. I'm just kind of was kind of like, I just want to devour the story and find out what's going to happen. And it, you know, made perfect sense to me where each of the chapters was and like whose POV it was from in that moment. So I feel like, I mean, from my perspective at least, I felt like it worked really well.
Thank you. That was a lot of editing. That back third, I rewrote. I completely rewrote that back third. And there was some additional things that I put in that weren't really there because I needed the Knox point of view in a couple places. So yeah, that back third was very troublesome.
Well, it's hard too. I would imagine. I mean, I'm not, you know, a novelist, so I don't know. But I would imagine that, like, when you're trying to figure out how to bring it all together in the ending, you know, that last third would be part of the toughest part to do.
It was because I had realized after the abandoned mall scene and things had have happened that I had lost all the narrative tension. And so I was writing that back third and I was like, how do I get this narrative tension back? Well, I will, you know, throw Ellery in a river. I will make them climb this pass. And it still just didn't really work all that well. So thank God for editors because she helped me so much with getting that, reworking that last third to make it, you know, a better book.
I liked too how we get to see like Knox's world and where the goddess is. I actually was wondering, I don't, based on what you've said so far, I'm guessing the answer is no, but I'm gonna ask you this anyway. So, because for me, when we go into that space and then come back out of it, and even some of the other things with the gods and goddesses, and then how like the fantasy creatures are just like spread throughout this contemporary city. Some of it almost made me think of like Greek mythology. Was there any influence at all from Greek mythology for this, or was that just kind of coincidence?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. It wasn't just me. Yes.
Oh, no, absolutely. Very much classical mythology jammed in this book that, and some of it is very recognizable. Some of it may not be so much because it's a little more obscure, but there's also a lot of different folklore. And again, that comes from just, you know, talking to D.L. Wainwright, who is a horror folklore author, and talking with him about just how to kind of use that some of those horror elements and some folklore horror elements. And so, yeah, so it's a real mixture of
Yeah.
classical mythology, you know, Greek mythology, classical mythology, and then different just kind of like folklore elements that pop up in a lot of different archetype folklore elements that are found in a lot of different mythologies that are like archetypal kind of things.
And I will say too, as far as like the horror part of that too, within that, the one god, his name is escaping me at the moment, the one who turns into a bird.
Bram.
He, yes. Now, what's funny is you said that you felt like Ellery was really a jerk, but Bram personally is the one that I would classify that way. But he, like, that the picture that you painted of his shrine, the like busted windmill, even just what I was picturing that, and I was like, you know, that's total like horror movie stuff right there. Just like, could just picture like this silent, you know, scene of just showing that and like slowly turning in the wind. And I was like near a cornfield, I was like, oh my gosh, like it just gave me shivers. Just that one tiny little part with like a paragraph description about it.
So that actually, this is funny, and this is actually not something that I have said on any other podcast yet. So I have mentioned that the corn statues is actually, there is a field of corn statues in Ohio, and it's called like Field of Corn or Corn Henge or something. Corn Henge is the colloquial term for it. And I borrowed from that and created my own corn statues. And the things around it, like the tacky stall of souvenirs and the path that walks around it, all of that is my own imagining. And basically where it came from and where the windmill came from is my first job out of college was I was a tour guide, and I was a tour guide for Colonial Williamsburg. And the building that I was in the most was one of the buildings that was by the windmill. And that grist mill that is at Colonial Williamsburg, they would turn it every so often and those kinds of things. And so it was something I saw every day. Every day I went into work, there was that windmill. And so when I knew I was writing a kind of messenger god, with like wind god kind of properties, I was like, what would be a good shrine? And that's the picture that popped into my head, was that windmill that I saw all the time when I went to work when I was much younger. The other funny thing about that windmill is that before I worked at Colonial Williamsburg, my brother-in-law worked at Colonial Williamsburg, and he told me this story of how he went into work one day and one of the arms was had fallen off.
Oh my goodness. Like, how does the whole arm of a windmill just fall off?
I don't know what had happened, and he was like, he went in to work, and he was a groundskeeper kind of person, and he said he went back there and he saw that the arm had fallen off, and was like turned around and walked back away because he did not want to deal with it.
Oh my goodness. I love it. I love it. This made me think of two. So, okay, part time, I am a children's storyteller and I dress as a fairy and we go to different festivals and events and things and do, like fairy tea time. And we mostly tell like classic Celtic stories about fairies. But we were asked, my partner and I were asked recently to go to a corn festival at, well, it wasn't, sorry, it wasn't a corn festival. It was a festival at the Carl Sandburg House, and which is in North Carolina. And it was like
Which is
celebrating,
right near me.
yeah. So, well, Carl Sandburg wrote a story about corn fairies and how corn fairies like help the corn to grow and all of this stuff. And so I had to learn this story for this event. And I was like, I have heard of like every kind of fairy ever, but I have never heard of corn fairies before. But your book totally made me like reminded me of it and made me think about the corn fairies too, with all the corn fields and the corn statues and that like Midwestern type feel to it also. And I was like, yep, all the fairy creatures.
That's hilarious. I've not re-read that story, but now I want to.
Yes. It's just a short little story that he wrote, very short, but it's fun. So, oh my goodness. Well, thank you so much for coming on today and talking with me about your book, Otherworldly. I've really enjoyed having you here and chatting with you about it and finding out more about your writing process and how the story came to be.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm sure your listeners will enjoy our little tangents about TV shows and corn.
Listen, if my listeners aren't used to my tangents by now, then, something's wrong. There's at least one on every episode, so it's okay. Well, as I said, everybody, Otherworldly came out on April 2nd, and you can pick it up at your local book retailer. I will put links in the show notes today to FT's website and their social media and where you can purchase Otherworldly as well. So make sure that you check it out because this is a amazing fantasy that you do not want to miss. Well, thank you everybody for listening today, and we will chat again soon. Today's episode featured the book Otherworldly by F.T. Lukens. I'd like to say a special thank you to F.T. Lukens for coming on the podcast and chatting with me today. And also a special thank you to Alex Kelleher at Simon & Schuster for setting up the interview. Be sure to follow YA Book Chat on both Instagram and Facebook, and don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you get your episodes as soon as they are available. YA Book Chat was created by, is hosted and edited by me, Leah Stuhler.